Welcome to this, the second of the Leveling Up lecture series. And this session is about skills. Skills that are appropriate for a society that provides good jobs for wherever you live in the country, basically, for a large majority of the population. And I want to introduce three people who are a superbly qualified between them to talk about this process. So I will introduce first the Baroness who is going to chair the whole process tonight of the discussion, which is Baroness Alison Wolfe. And Baroness Wolfe has, Baroness Professor Wolfe, I'm sure there's some other titles as well, but she has two different hats on. And she's speaking tonight with only one of those hats on. And that hat is as a professor at King's College London, where she is a world authority on this whole subject of skills. And she's had a lifetime of work on this. Her other hat, we should say, is that she spends part of her week in the policy unit at 10 Downing Street, where she also advises on a very similar topic, shall we say. But tonight she is speaking purely in her capacity as an academic, and that is important to recognize. Sitting next to her is Sir Chris Husbands. And Sir Chris Husbands is an academic, but he's speaking in his capacity as Vice Chancellor of Sheffield Hallam University. And Sheffield Hallam University is generally the top rated university in the country for student engagement, both for the learning experience that students get whilst at university, but also in the interaction between the university and the city and region in which it's located. So he's going to be really speaking in this capacity as Vice Chancellor, rather than as an academic in his own right, but of course he's allowed to stray into a wider area of expertise. And then, extremely excited and honored that that Ian Stewart has somehow found the time to come here. Ian is the chief executive of HSBC, which is the first of the major banks to relocate out of London to a provincial city, Birmingham, and is also a major employer in South Yorkshire. And so Ian is here in three capacities tonight, but the first capacity is that he is a major employer of skilled labor in Birmingham and in South Yorkshire. And so he's the pioneer of a major firm employing skilled labor outside the magic circle of the Southeast. And so in his capacity as an employer in a major provincial city, this is a really exciting, he's pioneered, and we want to learn about that pioneering role. But HSBC is also got a huge footprint in the Midlands and South Yorkshire. It is a major bank operating with SMEs, small and medium firms in those regions. And so the second role is he's in, at the top of a massive group of people deciding on loans for these SMEs. And it's in that capacity where he's also very important. Have these SMEs got the skills needed to prepare a convincing case for a loan? And that's enormously important because SMEs outside the Southeast have got to grow. And at the moment, the finance for SMEs is very heavily concentrated in the Southeast. So, for example, 2/3 of all the venture capital finance for SMEs just goes to the South, to firms in the Southeast, because the financial system is so heavily concentrated in London. So these are the roles that we're particularly excited to hear Ian talk about. And on that note, let me hand it to Baroness Wolf, who in her professorial capacity will guide the discussion forward.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you, everybody. I thought that it might be helpful to everybody if I started the proceedings off by just giving us a quick history tour, in a sense, because skills, the need for more skills, whether or not there's a skills crisis, this is something that people talk about constantly. But it's also very easy to talk past each other. And also, I think, very easy to miss the fact that while there are some areas where we have major challenges, there are also some areas where actually we do very well. And first of all, I think it's quite helpful to go back and look at what this country was like not that long ago. So Clara, if I could have the first slide. I think it's really important to realize how rapidly this country has changed, and indeed the world has changed, and the impact this has had both on the skills that we need and on the infrastructure that provides them. So if you went back, you know, really just to the 1970s, a very large proportion of school leavers who left school at 16, and most people did, went into apprenticeships. University was for a tiny minority. Most professions, which these days are graduate, people trained through articles, which was effectively a form of apprenticeship. And it was a very different world. I mean, in the context of tonight and our concern about leveling up, this was a more level land. Manufacturing employment were important. They were much more geographically dispersed. And also, this was a period when towns still had, as they had had since the beginning of the century, typically what was often known as the tech rather than the further education college. And that was where apprentices did their off-the-job training. These were very vocational institutions. And the thing I'd like to emphasize, they were very, very closely linked to local employers. If you were running such a college, you got some of your income from usually local government, not central government, but you've got a lot of it directly from your local employers. Now, today, jumping over a lot of very messy and complicated policy in between, apprenticeships are very difficult to obtain. They're highly desired by many young people. They're difficult to obtain. They are better than they were 10 years ago, but they are in short supply. But what we haven't said is we have a mass higher education system. And I think it's impossible to discuss the challenges of our current skills system without being aware that we have created a gigantic higher education system, as have most countries in the world, in the developed world. And so we've got about 50% of the cohort attending. That's, you know, not, we're high in the OECD tables, but we're not particularly unusual. And compared to the 1980s and the 1990s, at the same time, adult and part-time participation are down. We've gone to a highly centralized system of further and adult education, funded by central government, managed by central government, although there's been some devolution to the mayoral combined authorities. And the numbers in the numbers who are actually taking further and adult education courses has been going down. And last but by no means least, of course, the economy has been transformed. So manufacturing has declined. Again, this is not just this country. We are no different from, for example, France in this respect. but our manufacturing has declined, and our globally competitive industries are increasingly service industries, and they're concentrated in a few parts of the country. So this is a massive change. And I think it's not surprising in many ways that our skills infrastructure has struggled to keep up. Next slide. So have we had a long-standing skills crisis? Well, yes and no. British governments have been obsessing about Germany since the middle of the 19th century. It's also true that we have had a huge upheaval in the economy. Manufacturing shrunk, regional inequalities have grown. To some extent, skills actually make things worse rather than better. Employers consistently do report major skill shortages. And the area which has shrunk really dramatically is the area of mid-level technical education. And that's somewhere where we are really quite distinctive. That if you looked at many of our competitor countries, what one thinks of as sort of technician mid-level skills and courses and provision are very poor. But also we have to be aware that, you know, our economy has continued to grow. It hasn't done very well since the 2008 crash, but we have gone on growing. We are not poor, quite the opposite. We are globally competitive in a range of industries. And our universities are excellent. They rank extremely high on all measures. And they do now educate the overwhelming majority of our professions. A few accountants have hung in, but otherwise this is a huge shift. So, you know, this is skills. And on this, we are doing pretty well. Next slide. So where are the problems? Well, if you look at lawyers and designers and economists and research scientists, I mean, no, we don't have a skill shortage. We're doing pretty well. We may have short-term problems, but lots of competition, everybody chasing the best, but there is no problem in the skill system at that end. We are not good at responding to rapid increases in demand and skill changes. If you look at the whole digital area, again, I'm not saying the rest of the world is doing great either, but there are genuine pervasive skill shortages, and we don't seem to be very good at responding to them fast. We have a long-standing and worsening shortage of technicians. We have a severe shortage of what used to be called skilled trades, craft, level three, construction, where we've actually set up a sort of vicious circle, it seems to me, where you rely on immigration for some of this, and then the skill system atrophies again, and then you rely on immigration more. And we also have HGV drivers, but, you know, honestly, I don't think that's an issue. I mean, of course it's an issue if you're trying to get stuff delivered, but I think we get too hung up on the idea that everything should happen instantly. So the skill shortage that's had the most headlines at the time that we're making this podcast is HGV drivers. I suspect if anybody watches this in 3 years' time, they'll go, what? Next slide. But this is what I want to underline as well. We are doing fine at the top end in many ways. Of course, we could do even better, but, you know, honestly, we're doing fine in many of the top end skills. We are not doing well in what's known as non-advanced adult education. And we have been for most of the century flatlining at best and getting worse at worst. So, you know, our apprenticeship numbers, which back in the 1970s were very, very healthy, are, you know, there are things that have got better. If you unpack that a bit, you'll find there are probably too many people who are older and employees rather than young. But, you know, it's not going up. It's actually going down. And adult education is also going down. And finally, I think, the last two slides. We have low levels of investment in skills by employers. It's an interesting question why, but we do. We had over half of male school leavers entering apprenticeships. Today, we have only about 5% of the 18-year-old cohort. At best, you know, 3% at worst in 2020. And government surveys show consistent declines in the volume of employer investment in training. And a lot of what employers do is statutory. And meanwhile, in our university sector, if I could have just the last slide, we have basically abandoned this mid-level, what used to be HND, HNC level training. It barely exists. We have huge numbers of people doing undergraduate degrees and very large numbers of people doing postgraduate degrees, and we have a great hole in the middle. So let me stop there, because I think that what that hopefully brings home is the fact that we have a very, very out of kilter system. It's not a total failure, but it's out of kilter. And it has got to this point alongside, and I would say it's not been unrelated to, the rapid shifts in the economy that have actually made a certain number of high-skill service industries extremely important, but where a large number of things, including the skills system, have not done anything to offset this in areas where the old industries are declining and where we've had developing this growing divergence between some parts of the country and other parts of the country. But at the same time, it's not just in those areas that we have a problem, because we are also just generally facing a situation in which there are real skill shortages in a key part of the economy. And the thing that is most evident, at least to me, is this, I would almost say flight from, but certainly inability to deal with, the need for people who are really very skilled, but not best served by training in universities. And those are also the skills which tend to be very, very closely linked to changes, often quite rapid changes in the technology and requirements of employers. And one of the things that strikes me most is this contrast between, you know, not a utopian past, but a past in which our system was much more closely linked to local employer needs and local employer demand than it is today. And the fact that those are the sorts of jobs which people used to effectively pay for the training themselves with employers, those are now, the training is paid for by government if it's paid for at all. A lot of the time, it's not paid for at all. So I'd like at this point to turn to my two experts on my left, Chris first, and particularly sort of interested in your perspective, because you attempt to run a very, very large university, and we both work in mega universities. One that started off with a very, very specific vocational orientation has developed over time, and is very plugged into its locality. And I'd like to ask first Chris from that perspective, and then Ian from the perspective of an employer working across the country, but also still retaining some presence in the Southeast, I think. you know, looking at this scene here, first of all, do you agree with my basic diagnosis that we have a top half that's functioning not perfectly? I mean, I could expand for hours on the problems with universities, but functioning pretty well and driving the prosperity that has been genuine in much of the last decades. And another bit which is really not functioning well, and above all, not serving local needs.
So Alison, thank you very much. I'm always struck whenever I listen to you by how much I agree with your analysis. And I think that's broadly right. I'm going to try and take in two or three directions to point out parts of the analysis. I think there are some slightly different things going on here. We have made some national policy decisions which I think have not helped. And they've not necessarily been the major drivers here, but at a time when the economy is changing, they've not helped. So for example, the 2012 fee settlement for universities makes it very difficult for students to borrow for less than a three-year undergraduate program. So what we saw after 2012 was this massive collapse in part-time participation in higher education. So think of that as a reduction in flexibility. And I think David Willetts, who is the architect of the reform, says that was an unintended consequence, and he's right about that. I think that worth saying, you're right to say that the problem is not in the top half of the system. That by and large, the university system is functioning well, has responded to market signals, has responded to market signals in ways that have perhaps been a bit less flexible than they should be, but by and large is working well. For me, the real difficulties lie in three areas. The first is, if we look to the sectors of the economy where you identify skill shortages, they're quite different. So in digital, it's absolutely clear that the economy is moving faster than the capacity of this or any skill system to respond to it. And that's a real challenge for skill systems in this country and internationally. And it probably means we need to rethink really hard about what's the vehicle for the delivery of skills in a very fast-moving part of the economy. I don't think the same applies in engineering, and I certainly don't think the same applies in construction. It applies a bit in construction with some of the intelligent construction work, but not entirely. So there's a big problem there. There's a second absolutely enormous problem, which is more unique to this country, which is this. If you happen to be an academically able young person, your route through the school and school system is clearly mapped out. It is GCSE, it is A-level, it is university. If you are different in any respect, the system is not clear. And the routes through the system for the, I'm going to use the phrase bottom 50%, but for the lower retaining 50% are less clear. And what is particularly challenging is that they become even less clear the lower down that distribution you are. And that's just a crazy way of constructing a system. It ought to be the other way around. The academically most attaining ought to have the most difficult route because they're the most able to navigate it. And the academically least able should have the clearest routes through. The third bit is that, as you said, we used to have a system which was well-structured around techs, FE colleges, as we now call them, around polytechnics, around universities. And we have, by and large, an institutional structure that is geared for an economy that no longer exists. Now, digging our way out of that, there's not a single route out of it, but I think holding those three different problems in our heads is partly what we need to do.
Thank you very much. Ian, over to you. Do you recognise these problems? And as an employer hiring, not across the whole spectrum, because there are obviously a lot of jobs you don't hire for, is this something that you recognise? And are there institutional changes we should be making? Or where would you start at a grand plan, or even a local plan?
Well, thanks very much, Alison. I really enjoyed your slides, and it's quite funny because there's a couple of pieces out of there that really resonate with me personally. So I left school at a very young age and went to a technical college. I went to night school to get my qualifications. And it was a technical college, and it was a really good establishment. And I think it was a good establishment, and it was very helpful to me. But it was all mature students that were there. It was people who were in their 20s, 30s and older who were there for further education. And it's interesting what you're saying about the... Chris, about the mapped out. If you've got an academic background or parents that push you, and I mean there's a big part here around parents as well and parenting, but how you're pushed in a certain direction, then it is very clearly mapped out for you. And then you've got this huge population who it's obviously not so well mapped out for. But let me tell you what we try and do as a business. You could get in quite deep here about, are you getting taught the right things at schools? But the first thing I look for when I'm employing is a really good attitude. And I think a really good attitude is crucial for us, because what we end up getting is we get a very nice canvas. And by a canvas, I mean generally well-educated people. And we take people very young who we would bring into our apprenticeship programs, and we've got our graduate programs, etc. But first and foremost, I would say that is the canvas. And then we spend years putting layers and layers of paint on that canvas by doing our own in-house training and development. And some of the things that we train on today are a complete mind shift from where we used to do our training, what we used to focus our training on. So we will train today people on resilience. Now, I don't know for people in the room or people watching, but you know, if you're in your 50s as I am, you know, nobody ever taught me anything on resilience. That was just something that was never done. We train people on empathy because we think empathy is a really important skill nowadays. So the skills that we're training people in are very, very different to what was maybe done before. And I really take on board your point, by the way, Chris, on speed. The world operates around speed now. And that causes all sorts of problems because we move billions of currency around the globe every single day, but it's a fraudster's paradise. So we've got to train people to spot what fraudsters are doing as well. These were things that even 10 years ago were not in a banking environment. And of course, with the much less use of cash, then traditional ways of being educated in a bank through was really the teller work in a bank is diluted quite a lot over recent years. What we've got to now think about going forward, I think, is the needs of our customers and what are going to be the needs going forward. And you have to train for those needs. And if I was really, really clever, I would tell you what those needs are going to be over the next 20 years. But of course, we can't do that. So you're always trying to second guess what the needs are going to be. But certainly in my industry, they will be quite different to what they were 20 years in the past. But people are still going to want to buy a home. People are still want to be insured. They're still going to want health policies. All the sort of basic products, I think, will still be with us, but they'll be quite different. And they'll want these products, like, immediately. So it's how you deliver products in a very safe way at the time that the customers want it. So the skills around that are quite technical.
I'm very struck by two things that you... Well, actually, I'm going to start by being something which, in a sense, you both said, I think, in different ways. Chris, you were talking about the fact that when things move very fast, it's really hard for any organized skill system to keep up with them. And I think that's right, because first of all, organized skill systems are inherently bureaucratic, and that's just the case. And I mean, if we go back to the favorite preoccupation of this country since the Great Exhibition, how do the Germans do it? But you know, if you're going to have an organized skill system with anything which produces qualifications or licenses or anything of the sort, and which has public money in it, particularly in this day of extreme accountability, you end up with something which is often very high quality, but often actually quite rigid. And I think you're right. I think if you take the examples that I had, which are sort of rapidly changing versus things where there's a clear skill set and we just don't have enough of them, engineering technicians, plumbers, whatever. I think they are different. And what you were talking about, Ian, is a large company which does do a very great deal of training. It has to, and it's equipped to, and it does it. Now, one of the things which is very depressing and, you know, pretty clearly established is that this, the employers of this country do not spend on average a lot on training. They don't spend a great deal. And I think there are probably a number of reasons for this, some good, some bad, but there will always be good reasons. And so I think that, you know, thinking then not just about a huge and successful company like yours, but thinking about smaller companies, smaller organizations, some of which may be very small, some of which will be sort of mid-sized. How do we make it possible for them to keep up to date? And I think this is highly related also to Paul, your preoccupation, well, not preoccupation, but you know what this is all about. If you're going to level up, then there is a real challenge for companies and employers in small places who are also in, you know, small, medium, moderately large, but not large companies. Because you are busy keeping yourself alive, busy keeping yourself employed. Your first duty is to you know, keep the thing working, you know, so keep your staff employed, keep your customers served. And actually generating training that keeps you up to date with a rapidly changing economy is very hard. And I'd like to come back in later to the issue of how do we actually make our technical further education colleges more overtly linked into local employers. But what I think comes out very clearly from what you have both said is that there has to, that a successful company, however tiny, has to change, has to train, has to be know what it is that's going on out there and has to move with it. And I do think that's hard. And just to tell a couple of sort of slightly depressing anecdotes, if you like. A couple of years ago, I did some quite interesting focus groups with small companies, you know, asking them actually about digital skills. These were successful small companies. On average, they would be employing sort of 10 to 15 people, could be sort of a couple of coffee shops, could be a travel agency. These were not mostly manufacturing, though one of them was a small manufacturing company. And I think that I thought they were good. But except when it was statutory, they didn't really train much. And partly it was because they were just, they weren't going bust, they were managing, they were doing okay. But I think partly it was that, particularly if you're a small company, it's very hard to just release people and send them off for a course. I mean, you know, how do you keep the place open? And it was partly that they just didn't really know how to start, what it was that they should be doing. So they chugged on. So what do we do?
I think one of the, so many sad things about the pandemic, but one of the great things about the pandemic is how well technology has worked. It's been phenomenal how well it's worked. We've got 240,000 employees globally, and I think we had 230,000 working from home within about 3 weeks. So it was unbelievable how well technology worked. I've got a theory in this, Alison. I might be miles wrong with this, but I think we're going to move into a very different place, and I hope we do, because society needs this. And it's one very simple word, which is share. I think there's an absolute need for a bank the size of us to share our learning out. And I think with technology now, you can do that much more easily. And I think what you saw through the pandemic is, when people are putting their minds together to come up with a drug to get us through this very difficult period, hundreds, thousands of people came together for the greater good. And I genuinely believe people like us who have got the infrastructure, we have got the capabilities, we've got to share that with small businesses. Because if you think about the UK, and the UK is a very interesting market, 6 million businesses in the UK, 5.7, 5.8 million are small businesses, of which 5.5 million are owner operated, so one person. You know, so it really is this movement of people. They don't have time to go and do all these other things they would like to do, but they can spare an hour to go online in the evening. They can find time to dial into an information session. Companies like us have got to share all this technical knowledge that we've got to allow others to expand. And we just have to stop putting our arms around it. And I think that would be a major step forward. And we should do it for society, if nothing else.
Perhaps less civic-minded CEOs than you to do it.
I think people are beginning to learn the lesson. The biggest one that's going to change over the next 20 years is climate. We're all finding our way on climate. I was in Glasgow last week at COP. I was hugely energized by the quality of the conversation, but I really did get the feeling of we have to share. And there was one topic that came out in the suburbs of the conversation, and that was around food. And the golden rule of a government, any government, is you must feed your population. And there was an awful lot of conversation about food shortages coming. We have to share the knowledge to make sure we feed our population. That's nothing to do with a bank, really. But, I mean, it was a very interesting set of conversations at COP on this last week.
Chris. So I'm going to pick up on a phrase, that word share. Before the pandemic, when I had my job involved in travelling a lot, every time I got off a plane, Ian, as an airport, I saw an advert for your bank, which invariably said the world's local bank. And I think there is, it may not be your strapline anymore, but there is something around the problem that you identified, Alison, is a multifaceted problem. There's no big solution to it. There may be a series of local solutions. And you get to slightly different places depending on whether you start from a business a skills provider, a young person. So that I think there's not a big answer to this. There's not an answer that, well, there is an answer that works for digital and for engineering and for HGV and for everything else, but it takes you down the road of a highly regulated skills system, and there are inflexibilities that flow from that. I can only on this talk about, and Paul invited me to do so, the things that we do as a university. And we're a university operating in a city region of 45,000 SMEs. So we run something called our iLab, which is really about giving students within the university opportunities to start their own business, and we will give them lots of support on that. We run the Sheffield Innovation Programme that provides skills and innovation development for now several hundred Sheffield City Region SMEs. Every department in my university has an employer advisory board that is there to make sure that the curriculum we offer is as industry-focused as it can be. Every degree program in every subject in the university has work-related learning and work experience embedded at every level, trying to shorten the lines between the skills provider and the market out there. Is that enough? No, it is not. Is that hard work? Yes, it is. But we have to find ways, I think. It is about, that's the word, sharing. It is about bringing together the supply side and the demand side in as productive and creative relationships as possible, accepting that there is not going to be a single solution that works in every sector.
Okay, so sitting here and listening to you guys, it sounds like it should be all fine because, you know... We've got civic-minded employers who are ready to share, and you know, mega universities which are plugged into their local economy. So what is going wrong?
Well, I'm going to go back if I can. To I think one thing on your slide where I think you're slightly wrong at 50% of the cohort participating. So I think the 18-year-old participation in HE is about 38-39% in this country.
50% will at some point. Yeah.
But the distinctions, I'm sorry to sound slightly academic about this, because that means that the 60% of the population that universities are not getting to, however well geared they may be. So there's something, what is happening to the layers below the higher education population, and that's a big challenge, and that's where I think the skills architecture, the institutional architecture, is very weak. You showed the declining participation in FE over the last 10 years. That graph would look pretty similar if that was the unit of resource in FE, which has also declined markedly.
So
you've got very stressed institutions that are really struggling. So I think if we want to go back, it's the yes, it's that top black line. That pretty well maps the decline in the units of resource. So we have significantly stressed parts of the skill system, which we absolutely need if we're going to be delivering on those mid-level skills. And we're not, and slightly more techie point, but we're not then articulating the relationships between different parts of the skill system. So you get into the track that leads you to university, and it's a tramline. You get into the track that doesn't lead you to university, and it's also a tramline. And that doesn't make very much sense in a world in which the skill demands are changing quickly, and jobs are going to change 3, 4, 5, 6 times in the course of a working life. So for me, that's the place that we need to focus. We've got a system. We've got parts of the system that are significantly stressed. They need to be de-stressed, and we need to articulate better the relationships between different parts of the system.
Can I follow through on that? Because it's really a question also for Ian. So suppose you are an employer, possibly in Birmingham or Sheffield, but possibly somewhere where smaller, and you are finding it very hard to get really good skilled employees, then, you know, obviously attitude matters, but truthfully, it's not the only thing that matters, is it? So you're finding it very hard. Where would you feel you could go for help in actually identifying people who are coming through with the relevant skills that might then come and apply to you, or even to put on something which suppose you were a medium-sized employer, but rather than a very big one, it was part of the country where you had a relatively small footprint, who would actually be able to do something more substantial for you? I mean, where would be your first port of call?
Well, I think we've got to be very honest with ourselves. Some people just will not move to another part of the world. So, I mean, if you look at what's happening with BBC right now, trying to move their colleagues to Manchester, you read about it, we're not moving. When we moved our UK head office from London to Birmingham, we moved 1,200 roles. We did not move 1,200 people. We moved about 100 people. Let's be honest, okay? That's how many people wanted to go, because they didn't want to move outside London. There was just this piece, I work in London, all the jobs are in London, etc. Which means you've really got to start planning. We started planning about 4 years out. And if there was a role that we knew was going to be in Birmingham in the future, rather than recruit into London, we recruited into Birmingham. And that was a bit clunky for a period of time, because people wanted to be in this head office environment, and they weren't. They were in somewhere else until the head office came to them. I think where it gets slightly more difficult, and if I think about the part of the world that I grew up in, a village of 1,200 people, you know, getting a certain skill set is quite difficult because people maybe did not want to locate there. Now this is where technology, I think, is a huge enabler. You can dial in, you can go online, you can get some of the skills. But at some point, you've also got to be quite brave and say, this, if it's manufacturing, if it's services, you may have to uproot yourself to go to where the skills are. And I think a lot of people are quite against that, but there is a reality check at some point where it's just not going to happen in the part of the world that you're in. And that's quite difficult, but I think it is reality.
You've gone to Birmingham. I mean, Birmingham is, after all, you know, a pretty big place. or Sheffield. I mean, my sense is that's probably not really hugely problematic. Am I wrong?
In the northwest, we've got a bank in Leeds as well. So one of the reasons we went to Birmingham was we didn't want to cannibalize talent in some of these other places. I mean, we have to be sensible about this. Let me just put it out there, because I get asked a lot by journalists, oh, why did you move to Birmingham? You never get the talent. That is very insulting. Okay, it is very, very insulting. We have had no, well, I'll caveat that slightly. We've had no problem getting talent generally. We've had a couple of pockets where it's been quite difficult. So if I look at marketing, for example, now we don't have a huge marketing team, but getting marketing people in Birmingham for whatever reason is quite difficult, because there's a real hotbed of it in London. But please don't tell me you won't get talent in Birmingham. We've managed to hire amazing talent in Birmingham, amazing talent in Leeds and in Chester, and we've got 3,000 people in Sheffield. And would you believe it, the biggest area of expertise in Sheffield is digital. So our real techies are in Sheffield. So thank you very much.
You recruited our chief technology officer. Well,
so we know how to hire.
Well, you know, but you have to, if you want really specialist skills, then you've got to know on your doorstep that you've got what I call feeders coming into you, and that's the education establishment. We are very lucky in the UK. We're privileged to live in a country like the UK where there's an abundance of education establishments who produce highly talented individuals. We've just not been as good maybe in the last few years because banking is not as attractive maybe as it once was. I think it's an incredibly attractive industry, but I would say that. But you know, you're competing now with big media companies, etc., who offer employees something slightly differently. So we've got to compete for that talent. And that's where it gets more difficult for SMEs, is competing for that talent.
I was going to say, this is a real issue. And I think it's an incredibly difficult issue. And I mean, we're talking about skills, but it's also just, you know, other people competing for those skills. So I mean, I think this is a real challenge. And let me push Chris a bit. And actually, both of you, because you said that there are a large, you know, you're saying we've got a wealth of institutions. But earlier you said, Chris, I think, and maybe I misheard you, that you thought the institutional structure was wrong. Is the institutional structure wrong, or is it actually just the funding that's wrong?
Well, you're right. I think I said that the parts of the institutional structure were stressed. And I think that there are ways in which we could with relatively small amounts of funding drive much better collaborations across different institutions. I mean, the experience over the last 20 years is that relatively small amounts of money that are tagged to specific outcomes or specific collaborations can drive change pretty quickly. So I think that's where I'd look. So I think that building a new set of institutions, it's back to the old problem that the economy changes faster than the scale
supply. And if you take sort of smaller towns, some of them have even lost a college, but most of them will still have a college. And so then the question becomes, how do you keep those colleges up to date? And that's a real challenge because they're small. And there is, and I think technology will take you so far, but if you are sort of working in an institution which is not part of a major city, there's a limit how far you get. Sorry. So again, the collaboration or?
I've got two different answers, and one involves a brief anecdote. It's quite interesting. We, just before lockdown, we went off to Worksop, where the National Trust has one of these time capsule houses that somebody had lived there from 1910 through to 1950. And when the National Trust took it on, it's as it was. And in the visitor centre, there are lots of photographs of Worksop in 1910. And it's a really vibrant economy. You know, there are lots of independent shops on the high streets. There are local manufacturers. And so one of the things that has framed the problem in towns is not simply the collapse of the challenges in the skill system. It's the really significant shifts in the economy. And that's a massive challenge. So in one sense, you know, that we can re-energize the skills providers in challenged small towns, but without the vibrant economy, you'll be pushing things uphill. Which leads me to my second anecdote and then my general point. Alison, you told me to read an absolutely fabulous book about Janesville in southern Wisconsin, and it is fantastic. And the story in Janesville is that the local Ford plant closes in 2007 at the time of the crash. The federal and state governments do everything right. They pour in money to skills and training, and the book traces the trajectories of families through it. And the investment in skills has almost zero effect because there is no way for the skills to be used.
And I think because the demand does not come from the local employers, it comes from big institutions that want to do well by people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So there's something around skill supply, but there's something bigger or as big about the way local economies work. How do you solve that problem? Well, you might have to accept you can't solve it. How do you reduce the problem? I think you have to get small institutions to pool risk. So it's collaboration. It's about shared training. It's about shared update. It's about collaborative course development. It's gearing the system to accommodate the problem that you've got in those institutions.
I think that's very interesting, I think that's right. Yes, I did indeed tell you to read that book. It's very very depressing and amazingly insightful. I mean, it may just a brilliant read, a brilliant analysis. But I think you're right, and it comes back to the point that I was making at the beginning, in a way, which, you know, I don't want to idealize, but you know, I didn't grow up in a village of 1,200 people, but I grew up in a small town of 17,000. And, you know, when I was a child, there were lots more businesses and lots more sort of locally focused employers, and they were very involved with the local tech. I mean, they were. I mean, when I started working on skills, I kind of went and, you know, cross-examined my parents and said, you know, I'm remembering this right. And I think this is also about risk sharing, of course. There's a real risk sharing element there. This was how they grew up. They grew up as a shared environment for training, above all, apprentices in those days. But generally, how might we recreate that? I mean, because that doesn't take away what you were talking about, Ian, which is the need to share what is going on in the outside world. But how might we try to actually recreate that? It won't transform the economy, but at least it will stop us simply pouring money from London, or indeed from West Midlands Combined Authority, into what somebody thinks might be a good idea?
If I were looking to sell practical ideas to government, here's one that I think might be worth exploring, and it involves spending a bit of money. There are about 400 FE colleges in England, slightly smaller than that now. So what I would do would be to create a fund of about 200 million. 200 million would, if you shared it out evenly, give them each about half a million. But I wouldn't share it out evenly. I'd make it for bidding. I'd say that it's for developing local skills, local skills offers, not strategies. The rules for bidding in are that you have to collaborate with other FE colleges and you have to collaborate with local university. And I think that that is still a lot of money, but that would begin to shift the architecture into slightly more permeable institutions, and you'd begin to get inter-institutional collaboration. And I think that, you know, we've learned that that sort of thing releases quite a lot of innovation. Would it solve the problems that you've put up on the slides on its own? No, it wouldn't. Would it get institutions working differently? Yes, it would.
Okay, so that sorts of institutions. What about the employers?
I would have a slightly different view on that. So I think in this day and age, that what are we trying to do here? We're trying to get young people. And I'm very privileged that I do quite a bit of work with the Prince's Trust and these sort of things. And you get to some, the most deprived parts of society. And if you can give people skills en masse, then I think that is the way forward. And when I was growing up, I mean, the Open University was like state of the art. And I would try and do as much as I could online. And I would do that because I think you can spread the knowledge out much wider. Now that's great to a point, but if you're doing practical work, I mean, training to be an electrician,
yeah,
not so easy. But you can do it. Video technology, et cetera, today is excellent. I would definitely try and do it online. Now, that raises all sorts of questions. Well, that's okay if you're connected at home, if you've got a computer, etc. And there's thousands who don't, by the way, have computers. Mm-hmm. But I think I'd be more tempted to put the money into the technology and give people access to this way, because there are thousands of people who are getting left behind. And if that doesn't concern you, I think it should. I worry about people getting left behind.
That too. I think Ian's right, but in a slightly different way than I'm suggesting. And I'll get two anecdotes to introduce this point. So our lavatory blocked during lockdown. And so what did I do? I Googled, I found a video, I set my laptop next to the lavatory and stepped freeze framing the video that was telling me how to fix the blockage on my lavatory, and I sorted it. And that, you know, that was a skill I was developing as I needed to develop it. And I think that works for adults. The Open University is fabulous. It never built up a clientele amongst 18-year-olds. So I'm with Ian on technology for post-experience, for experienced workers, for later life. Ironically, I think there's something about socialization, there's about community, which is, and the evidence seems to me to suggest that you need face-to-face supervision with younger people.
Can I just build on that for a second, Chris? Because I think there's another point we've not touched on yet. Is we're talking about people here, or generalizing, that all these people want the education and they want to develop. There are a huge part of the population who are disengaged, shall we say. That's the word I'd use, I'm being polite, but disengaged. And it's how we get those people. There's huge amounts of talent out there who are, for whatever reason, it might be their upbringing, it might be their home life, etc., have fallen out of the tracks a little bit, and we should really try and get those people back on track. And everyone can't be I'm going to shoot for the stars person, but there's a lot of, I'd call, latent talent that we need to get back in. And there's one population I think. As an organization, we failed. And I take this personally because I'm quite heavily involved in it. And that's the disabled community. a lot of the disabled community do not work because it's just too difficult to get these people into work, etc. They are very talented people, but for whatever reason, as a society, we've not been that good. Look at Egypt. Egypt bring their disabled people in. So we've got a lot of talented people who we need to bring in, and I'm using one. It's maybe a good example. It's maybe a bad example. But don't think everyone's bursting at the seams to get there. We need to generate this enthusiasm and this way. If you want to be successful, and success is in everyone's own mind, it doesn't matter what I think, it's what they think. But just to get them back on track and give them a job, make sure they understand money. And I might be off piece, but I might be on it as well. I would suggest that part of that goes back to the curriculum at school. We do not teach life skills at school. We've been pushing the government for some time. I think the curriculum could change a little bit. Mm-hmm. I've got four children. So, well, how do you get a mortgage, Dad? Right, well, we're at basic level here. You know, so we've got to educate people on how do you get a mortgage? How do you get life insurance? How do you do a will? All these things are just life skills that we don't teach.
Okay, I suppose I'd like to come back to the place issue, though, because this is, after all, what we are trying to focus on. And I'd like to come back to this issue. So you have a town with which will still have small employers. It won't, you know, you're right. For a variety of reasons, the high street probably doesn't bustle. It doesn't have the same, but it does have employers. You know, it has employers, and some of those could become considerably more productive. They could become bigger. They could grow, and for them there is a real challenge. And you know, I think I heard some good ideas about large industries, large businesses sharing up to date training stuff, and some good ideas about institutional collaboration. But I want to really come back to this because it also relates to the very depressing statistic I put up, which is, you know, from a variety of government sources, which is that on the whole, British employers do not spend much on training. And I think your point about risk sharing was actually absolutely right, because the only way you sort of generate this really on a large scale is by actually creating a different environment, an environment in which you bring employers together more actively and give them some reason to come together more actively in a way which sparks people off, which means that, you know, you discover that actually you might all want to take an apprentice in a given area, which means that the local college would actually be able to have enough of them to put on a course because it would actually be economically viable, or that several of them actually can see a way of wanting to make contact with, for example, HSBC down the road and have some regular stuff. How do you actually get that going? And it does seem to me that the FE colleges have to be somewhere in the center of it. I mean, we do have this inherited institutional framework. And how might we do that? Because I think your bidding idea will get some good institutional stuff, but it's actually more sort of how in a way do we change the incentives, the risk sharing, the behavior more generally. I didn't give you warning of this, and since I don't have the answer, but I would like to suggest in the leveling up context that if we could do that again, if we could create the sorts of incentives that brought businesses together in the first place to create and fund these institutions, we would actually on the skill side be making a major step forward, and we wouldn't be falling into the trap that Ford Motor Company did, you know, with the best of intentions of sort of offering people training, only it was just training sort of in a vacuum.
Yes, I mean, look, I'm the short answer to your question is I don't know.
I think that it's
longer answer would go something like this. I buy your historical analysis, right? I don't disagree with much of any of it. The question is whether we are trying to recreate something which we have lost, or whether we need to create something which is new. And I think in that sense, the historical analysis might slightly mislead us. You know, that world has probably gone. So something different needs to happen. It is true that UK employers do not invest in training, that employers in other countries do invest more in training. And I have never entirely understood whether that is tax compulsion, tax credits, or whether it's something that is culturally different. I don't know the answer to that, and I'd like to understand it, because it points us to a sort of answer. I do think that there is a slight tendency in this to somewhat overgeneralize about skills. Skills can be very specific. Skills, it's whether it's me fixing my lavatory or your children getting a mortgage. You know, they are quite specific, and they look different in different contexts. And that's why I do come back to my Energize Local initiative. I did make a mistake earlier when I talked about incentivizing colleges. I should have said employers as well. I think you've got to engage that, and that was an oversight. But I think you can then begin to move things. And the most successful bits of the global economy are those which have found specialist niches. So we can all talk about technology around Boston or technology in Silicon Valley, but there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't see a niche developing, a different niche around Grimsby or around Great Yarmouth. What would that niche be? I don't know. Do I think that the employers and skills providers in Grimsby would have a better answer than me? Yes, I do.
Just so I'm give a view on it. Education for me is all about passing knowledge from one to another. And all across the land, you've got schools, colleges. So you've got a facility to do that. If I've ever asked anyone for help on education or coaching, I don't think anyone's ever said no.
Absolutely.
So you've got this massive population of either newly retired or taking early retirement people who are highly skilled, very well educated, who would only be too happy to pass that education on to others. There's something there about latent talent available, especially in some of the smaller, more rural areas, where by opening up some of these other facilities, I am sure people would share their knowledge base. Now that's very unstructured, so it's maybe not helpful, but if somebody asked me to help out, go to a school in an afternoon or an evening, I would be only too happy to go and do that, to pass on what knowledge I've got to others. And this is going back to this whole sharing part, which I think the pandemic has given us a real push in the right direction. And I think climate will just really accelerate that. Yeah, and so we, you know, as a country, we could really think about how we open up this amazing talent pool we've got for the greater good for all. It would take some organizing, but with the right will, there has to be a way.
Okay, final question before I ask the audience physically and virtually. We've been talking about particularly I have been talking about the fact that we sort of move from one kind of society to another, and that our system has, in some cases, adapted extremely well, and in others has not, and so we have these particular shortages, and we also are struggling to keep up with things that move very fast. If you were, for example, well, maybe I ask you, Chris, for yourself as well, but if you were sort of thinking about, you know, 20 years from now, if I want to sort of start worrying now about where I'm pretty sure we're going to have too little capacity, mm-hmm. Apart from climate, you know, where would you put your money, knowing that you will be wrong in the detail, but where would you put your money in the broad?
Well, I know you said apart from climate, but I do think that that's going to become an overwhelming issue, which is going to permeate almost all other parts of the economy. There's not going to be a thing around climate. It's the water in which we're going to be swimming for the rest of my life, certainly. So I wouldn't accept climate. I think that digital, where if we just think about the pace of change in digital technologies over the last 20 years, you know, look ahead. it's very, very difficult to see that. And that also, I think, becomes ambient. You know, artificial intelligence, which I'm putting under my heading of digital, is going to move increasingly through finance, through manufacturing. So those are probably two massive ones. I think there's a really big question around the issues that will flow from an aging society. And it's possible to think about that in terms of social care, but I think as well, there's whole sets of issues around design and delivery for aging societies that as we get older, if we want to maintain independence, there's some questions. So for me, the big drivers are going to be climate, digital, and aging.
Yes, I mean, like, where would you put your bets now? My heart tells me manufacturing, because as a country, you have to make things, okay? You have to make things. I love a production line and it comes off the end. However, I'm a great believer in keeping these debates as simple as we can. So what do we need? Now, if you think about just what you need to get through life, you need food, you need health. So I completely agree with that, Chris. And it's an aging population, so you need health. You need a roof over your head. We live on an island. There's never going to be enough homes in the UK. You've got 28 million homes that are going to need to be retrofitted before 2050. So if I came back reincarnated now, I'd be a heat pump manufacturer, or I'd be a plumber or an electrician, because it's all going to have to get done. We are the combustion engines at the end of its natural life. You're going to be driving electric cars, whether you like it or not. Personally, I quite like it. I don't have one yet, but I will get one. But you need an infrastructure for that. So I'd be building the infrastructure. And then the other thing you've got to think about is power. And I know maybe we don't want to talk about climate, but the whole axis of power is changing. If you think about aviation, sustainable aviation fuel can now be manufactured. We've now got to scale it, because people don't want to give up flying, but they don't want to pollute the planet. So I just think power is going to be a massive change over the next few years, hydrogen, etc. And it's exciting, but it's going to be quite demanding on resources as well. But certainly health's a big one as well. I know.
Yeah, the thing I would sort of note about most of this is that there's a couple of cases where what we're talking about is high-end development and the bit we're good at. But, you know, honestly, what it also says is that a lot of that is stuff you do everywhere. Which I think, again, comes back to this question of how we think about motivating people, making it easier for them to stay. Because the vast bulk of jobs related to this are actually going to be everywhere in the country. And, I mean, I'm actually also quite keen on manufacturing. Just never, ever, ever is going to employ many people again. It just isn't.
And use my privilege as being on the stage. We've got an audience here and an audience online. It's
about time. So I think we have 20 minutes.
Just about time to open up to questions. Sure. Online questions are perfectly fine. I'm going to abuse my position on stage to ask the first question, really. And I'm going to start with a little anecdote about myself, because it picks up on what Ian was saying about there's a vast pool of people who are willing to provide advice and mentoring to young people. And my parents both left school at the age of 12, so I was the first generation of getting a chance to go to university from Sheffield. So I was very much a pioneer of trying to, and I reached a point where I had a terribly important decision to take, and I knew I wasn't equipped to take it, and so I needed somebody who was a middle-class person who could give me advice. And I thought, who could I ask? And I could think of only one middle-class person that I interacted with regularly, and that was my dentist. And so I asked my dentist for mentoring advice, and I have to say, he was completely useless. So we can do better
Ian, by pulling in people who are a little bit better equipped to mentor, but I think there's still a huge gulf in that mentoring role. And then I wanted to draw both of you, because both of you are pioneers in different ways. Chris has pioneered the use of a university to actually train people in a range of locally pertinent skills and engaged with local firms. And you, Ian, have pioneered recruitment in a provincial city. And both of you, as far as I can see, have learned by, to an extent, a process of trial and error. And that seems to me a perfectly acceptable way to learn, is get going and try things. And not everything will work, but you adjust, you learn by doing. And there hasn't been enough doing. There's been the Obama problem of a rolling seminar discussing policy, but not enough actually doing things to learn from experiment. And finally, we could learn from success. And the idea that there's no success outside London is very clearly false. Ian gave the example of where do they go to for IT skills? Sheffield. Why? Because Sheffield has got 800 IT firms. It's a major IT cluster. There are enormous clusters of new skills all around the country, but unrecognized. And so one learn from that IT cluster in Sheffield, there may be many other clusters that can be harnessed and that they're new and they're unrecognized. And finally, we can learn from success in colleges of further education. As Chris said, there are 400 of them. Barnsley College is in the top 10 nationally. Now, the distinctive thing about Barnsley College is that Barnsley doesn't have a university. And so the local government really has focused on making Barnsley College good, because they've no other choice, and it seems to have worked. So could we learn from the success of Barnsley College for the other 390 that are not as good? So this is a suggestion, so to throw the whole thing open.
Brilliant. I think what I'd like to do is take two or three questions as well as following up on that, and then let both Ian and Chris have a... Sandra. Hold on, we need a microphone.
Okay, thank you for the very stimulating discussion this evening. And it raised many questions in my mind. I'll just ask one. There was a lot of discussion about changes in the workforce, how fast things change. In view of how fast things change, what does the panel think about the post-16 curriculum? Do you feel it's narrow in England relative to other countries? And how would you change that? I mean, is that something for vocational or is it something for academic as well? And the same question about apprenticeships. Are apprenticeships in England too narrow?
Okay, let's end back there as well. I'd like to take there and there, and then once we've had those three questions plus Paul, then.
Thank you very much. It's impossible to argue with the data that Baron has presented regarding the system being out of kilter, obviously, and the need for domestic upskilling in some form. But I want to know, with respect to this idea of, do we just want to recreate the past, or should we be looking to a new future? With that thought in mind, I'm wondering, with your respective hats on, to what extent you all think immigration should play a larger part in satisfying long-term, in particular, labour market demand. I'm mindful of the fact that immigration keeps being presented as a veiled option rather than an immutable necessity, perhaps. So I'm wondering whether immigration is part of the solution here, if indeed it's the case that, as in Janesville, I think it was, all the upskilling in the world in a town might not be enough to actually stimulate local economies.
And this...
Hello. My question has got to do with unused apprenticeship levy. I think there's about $1 billion that companies are not able to use for their own staff. Does anyone know what happens to that money? Because you see the decline in provision for further education. You're wondering why apprenticeship levy that's unused is not being used for that.
I can answer that one. That's a specific empirical question. I can actually answer that one. Yeah. Shall I start by answering that one? Without wanting to go into huge detail, the levy is basically, it isn't really a levy, it's a tax. It's a tax on large companies. And it goes into the treasury, and the amount that is not used by the companies, which has been going down, is then goes into the treasury pot, and it then makes an allocation to pay for apprenticeship training in SMEs, in small and medium firms. You're right that there is, over the last few years, it hasn't all been spent. You know, it's a slightly complicated system, because basically it's described as a levy. It's really a tax, but you don't pay it if you actually use it. Train an apprentice. The Treasury would say that they have worked on predictions and that they intended to, it was expected that they would use it all. But the amount that is unspent has been declining as the amount that is spent by levy payers goes up. One of the reasons that apprenticeship numbers have fallen, well, there are two major reasons, one good, one not so good. Numbers fell because there was a big apprenticeship reform and the government stopped supporting very short, very low quality apprenticeships a few years ago. So that brought the numbers down. But the other problem, which I think is an interesting one, to which I don't have an answer, is that the levy payers in particular have been tending to increase the level of the apprentices that they take on. They will often, there are more and more high-level apprentices, and they cost more because it goes on for a large number of years. So the amount of the levy that has been unpaid has actually been falling, and so far, Treasury has continued to treat it as though it was a sort of hypothecated pot. So what happens is that if they don't top it up over and above the levy, because they work on the basis that pays for everything, then that's it. But there is, alas, not a nice pot sitting of £1 billion which one could put out. It runs into all the usual fights over mainstream government expenditure, alas. So on that one, I can give you a straight answer.
Let's have a couple of words on it. I'm really sorry, even just listening, how complicated a response that is.
Yes, I know, it's horrible.
Okay, is tells you everything I would tell you about the apprenticeship. Yes. As somebody who's caught in the middle of it, I think it needs an overhaul. I don't think it's really good value for money, because it's not going to the heart of the problem. The opening words were that it's a complicated system. It's a complicated system. What do we need just now? Straightforward, get people into apprenticeships, put the money behind it. We'd be delighted to put the money behind it, rather than trying to fudge it, which is roughly what we're doing at the moment. I honestly desperately think it needs an overhaul.
Absolutely, the answer sort of says a lot, doesn't it? Okay, over to you guys on the other questions and on responses.
Do you want to go first?
Okay, I'll rattle through them quickly. Sandra started off of speed of change. The speed of change is incredible just now. I worry that will I keep up, and I hire lots of young, smart people to keep me up to date with technology. I'm a dangerous amateur on it, Sandra. Cloud technology, I'm really trying to self-educate myself. Do you think the education system is too narrow? Yeah. The more I see it now and the closer I get to it, I think it could just do with expanding it a little bit. But I think it's really difficult and I don't have the answer. Do I think apprenticeships are too narrow? No. I think they're very wide and very varied. I just think we should use it more. And that was a good introduction there. Immigration. I'm an open capitalist economy guy. You know, I would have the doors open. I think you've got to be careful with some of the rules, etc. And I get all that. But if you want a growing economy, I think you've got to be more open than perhaps we are today. I think I've covered that.
I'm largely going to agree. I absolutely agree on immigration. I mean, my read of the data is that there's very little evidence that immigration depressed demand for skill or demand or wages. What it tended to do was to grow the economy. Now, the caveat on that is that there may be particular geographical locations where that was experienced differently. But from a national perspective, I'm with you on that. On post 16, Alison and I have had sort of exchanges on this before. There is some path dependency, and crudely, one of the things to remember about post 16 education in this country is that it was by and large constructed as a basis for university entry, and the system that we've got means that we can have 3-year degrees rather than 4-year degrees. I think that the post 16 curriculum is too narrow. It probably does need to be subject based. I don't have a disagreement with that. But it is too narrow. It forces early specialization. It closes down choices. I am, where I sit, worried that T levels are probably going to reinforce trumlining rather than opening up choice. And that feels to me to be a bad thing. It's not the way that most of the rest of the world is going. And I'm don't think, Paul, we've picked up your questions. There's an interesting question about FE colleges and what they do in areas where they are the sole, in a sense, provider of post-16 training. And you're right. And the interesting question is this. Do we think, and I think I'm reasonably conservative about this, do we think that we've basically got an institutional structure that could deliver if it was incentivized properly? I think I'm quite conservative. I think the answer might be yes. Or do we think that we need some new types of institution? I think that we've broadly got an institutional structure which is not appropriately incentivized, but is a broadly appropriate structure.
We had some more questions. There was a gentleman over
there. Can we take some from online?
We were taking some from the ether.
Right.
Okay.
Sorry, there's quite a few, that's all. Andy asks, how do we begin to address the adult skills issue as 80% of the UK workforce in 2013 are already behind, as in post-education, upskilling? And Abigail has asked, does the panel have any suggestions on what we can do to innovate online learning, given that most of the working population is burned out from statutory regulated learning? The last one, what do you think about the effect of AI on the future available jobs and the impact on training providers and trainees?
You go first. Okay, these are all extremely good questions. I think I'll take them in the reverse. I think the AI question is a really tough one. And it falls into me the category that can we predict future skills with certainty? And I'm not sure we can. So what do I think is going to be the long-term impact of AI? I have no real idea. And I think this is a sort of grope forward, establish broad principles rather than specifics. And I think that if you try to over-predict that, you will over and therefore misspecify. So that's not a very helpful answer. How to incentivize online learning? I'd want to flip back on something that Ian said that I thought was absolutely right. And it's both something that we need to respect, but it's also a challenge. I think that there's some suppressed demand for upskilling, but there's quite a lot of people who don't necessarily want to. And we should respect that, but it's also the consequence of the problem that we've got economies that are locked into this low-skill, low-productivity equilibrium. And unless we can create economic incentives in which people, and this is the Janesville lesson. Everybody thought that the unemployed Ford workers needed to upskill, but there was no local demand for them to use those skills. So they became disenchanted, disengaged. In many cases, the relationships fall apart. It's a really sad story. So how to encourage innovation in online learning? People pick up this when they see the need for it. Most people are rational actors, like me and my broken lavatory. I know I'm generalizing from experience and one in my bathroom. But I think that sense is really important, that the demand will be there when there is a need for it. The 80%, the adult skills problem, I think, is absolutely right, and it is the really big one. Partly falls under the problem that, you know, where is the need, where do people see there's a gap, but it is a much bigger and more challenging problem than the supply of new workers. You know, we can address the supply of new workers through some qualifications reform, through some institutional incentivization, but that big chunk of people, most of the people who are going to be in the workforce in 2028 are already in the workforce, and their jobs are being reconstructed around them. That's a daily challenge for all of us.
I won't go through all the questions, but I would like to just talk about AI for a second. So I think artificial intelligence in the next 10 years, not even the next 20 years, next 10 years, is going to be significant, because we're going to move into a world of hyper-personalization. And everyone wants, when it comes to technology, a made-to-measure suit. So it's just made for you, and this is the way it's going to go. Now, I worry about that, because there's some massive unintended consequences of that as well. Because you may take people out of the economy as much as you take people or bring people into the economy. And we have to be very aware of that before we go in. The reason that the AI is exciting is it's just enormous data getting configured in a certain way. The one area we don't know, and I'm sure there's better brain power in this room than me who maybe do have a good view of this, is that what are the future behaviours going to drive? So if somebody had said to me 10 years ago, Deliveroo, all these sort of takeaway companies for food were going to be massive and worth the amount of money they are today, I would have laughed. But customer behaviours have changed. And so the next 10 years is us trying to second-guess customer behaviours, and I don't know what they're going to be at the moment. But AI is going to play a huge part in that. So exciting, but with quite a few worries as well. All about data.
Time for maybe two more questions.
Hi, thank you for this great panel discussion. Learned so much. I wanted to ask about esteem. And, you know, when we talk about creating jobs for people, it kind of creates, you know, a sense of esteem. So being at Oxford University creates esteem. But maybe going to like a further education or another university may not create as much esteem. So it creates this disparity within people. So I was wondering how you think about the future of accreditation for different institutions and how people, you know, the messaging that goes out that if you go down a certain path, which is not quite clear yet for people that don't go to university, how do you build that in a community? Because it's not just about the job, it's about what that means to that person and the community, I feel.
Well, first of all, thank you for using the word esteem. I was trying to think of the right word earlier. I think esteem is a very good word. I would maybe use the word pride, and I think a lot of people in small communities have got real pride. When I was growing up, I had real pride in my community. You know, you play for the local football team, etc. There's a real pride piece. How you energise people is quite a challenge. I think I don't have the answer to how you do that, but I think it's, dare I say, it's maybe how you're brought up, where you're brought up, the environment around you, this caring, loving environment, etc. And I think people who come from that background have got a huge advantage as they go on to further education. I wouldn't underestimate that for a second. Somebody who I've got to know is a good friend in Manchester who does a huge amount of work in the community. I mean, I've been out with him and seen what it's like on the other side of that. And trying to get people energised and pride is so difficult. So I don't have a brilliant answer, but I like that word esteem because I think it's really important.
Thank you so much for a great talk. I have a question related to how we see the skills crisis related to income inequality, because I think a lot of what you were saying was there's this need for more technical education and for apprenticeships, but then on the other side, my first thought is, are we funneling people into jobs that don't necessarily pay very well, and will that to some extent exacerbate income inequality?
Both of those two final questions are just absolutely huge and open, really challenging questions. I mean, So the short answer to your question is that if it's really hard to predict skills needs in the economy, it's even harder to predict long-term wage developments in the economy. So where that leads me, and I'm going incredibly fast on this because I could probably talk for the next 2 hours on this, and I don't think I'd be terribly popular with anybody if I did, is that you've got to create opportunities that where people make decisions that look good bets in the short term that turn out to be bad bets. You've got to create opportunities for those to be revisited. And one of the major challenges that has driven income and regional inequality in this country is that we didn't do that well when manufacturing industry collapsed and we left significant communities and populations high and dry, which has generated a whole range of social, economic, political, and cultural problems that we're now wrestling with. So there's an interesting set of questions about how many coal mines there are left in France, and the answer is none. They also closed all their mines, but they invested a lot more money in ensuring that communities had other routes out of deindustrialization than we did.
They also have a significantly higher unemployment rate than we do and a truly messed up youth labour market. That's a whole other discussion.
But for me, if you want to look at this system from the point of view of the users, the skills users, accept that some of them are going to make bad choices. We all make bad choices in life. And you create a system that allows people in a sense to reverse out of the cul-de-sac and get back onto the road. That's important.
So I think we used up our time. So let me draw to a close with these last two questions about esteem and inequality. And the answer, I think, to esteem is that we need more Ian Stewart, who became the head of one of the biggest banks in the world through night school and technical training, right? Yep. If we had 1,000 people like you being generated each year, and we were celebrating that, the balance of esteem would very rapidly shift. So that's an esteem point. And let me finally turn to the inequality point. There was a very interesting survey just a few months ago in Britain about what aspects of inequality really, really mattered. In fact, it was done at King's. The result was surprising to the researchers, though not surprising to anybody who'd lived in the real world, which was that there was only one thing in the whole country that people really came together to agree about inequality. And that was that we had to reduce spatial inequality, that what opportunities you had to earn a good living should not depend upon where in Britain you were born. And at the moment, if you're born in London, you've got a 72% higher income chance than in outside the southeast. And so what we've really got agreement on, consensus in Britain, and we're so divided that there's not much consensus, but it's to tackle that spatial inequality. And that's why we've got this course of discussions on levelling up, which will gradually build. And I wanted to close with a sentiment that I think was best articulated probably by Chris, that that skills, the demand for skills very much depends upon the job opportunities to use those skills. And so the skills
that equipping people with better skills has to go hand in hand with growing the jobs that are generated predominantly by SMEs in the country. And that's why very shortly, we've got a very important session on how to get better finance to SMEs, which is a huge task. So hand in hand, this series of discussions on levelling up will gradually cover the waterfront of the interventions where all these complementary interventions will gradually build up to a much more spatially equal society. On that, I really do want to thank Baroness Wolf, Sir Christopher Husbands, and Ian Stewart. It's notable that the head of the biggest bank is the only person without a title. And if we wanted to level up esteem, we might want to do something about that, but no comment is called for here. But thank you. Thank you very much indeed for a superb discussion.
Thank you. Very good question. Thank you.